Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of April 16th, 2010. You know, some people practically turn themselves blue to be more green, install solar panels, put a compost bin in the backyard. Others just want to save some green and maybe in the process be green without a lot of fuss.
For the light fixture, claiming that it's going to save you a lot of money, it makes sense. I have no problem with that.
Hear the earth-friendly side effects of a down economy. Plus, with all the finance scandals of late, wouldn't you just love to see justice served? You can, on TV.
No one seems to be telling the truth that people are being taken advantage of. Our desire was to put an attorney front and center who will fight for those people and try to get at the truth.
A little later, we'll have a conversation with the creators of Damages on FX. But first, we want to kick things off by wishing you Happy Financial Literacy Month. So how are you celebrating? Brushing up on the basics of compound interest, maybe? Doing the math on your emergency fund? Or perhaps you're taking a couple of hours to review and rebalance your portfolio? Well, if you've been watching the Dow more closely than we generally recommend on this show, you know it topped 11,000 this week. The meteoric rise from 1 year ago is setting off warning bells in some quarters and talk of another bubble. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to look into it.
When I was a junior at Swarthmore College, economic history professor Bob Duplessis taught me everything I know about bubbles.
As I remember, you used to sit there with a little hint of puzzlement.
Puzzlement, maybe because I couldn't understand how the titans of capitalism, 17th century tulip merchants or 20th century investment bankers, could follow a pipe dream of ever-rising prices to disaster.
There are actually a number of positions about what a bubble is. We don't actually know what lessons ought to be learned.
David Blitzer of Standard & Poor's says while bubbles are hard to identify and prevent, they all have one thing in common, a new idea.
Something starts to get things going, called displacement. It might be the stories of the mid-1990s. It's a new economy. The internet will solve all the problems in the world. It might be very low interest rates and the idea that you got to buy a house because home prices never go down.
Back in the housing boom, that new idea drove Michael Russell of Minneapolis and millions like him to invest in property that was going up 10, 20% a year. It was property they couldn't afford, so they borrowed to the hilt to get in the door.
I bought my house 3 years ago for $183,000, which at the time, you know, that was 2007, really was not out of the question. Now, the house across the street from me a year ago sold on foreclosure for about $37,000.
Russell's now trying to sell. He told me comparable homes in the neighborhood are going for 30% below what he paid. He anticipates selling for tens of thousands less than he owes on the mortgage. But while it's obvious now that prices were massively inflated, Blitzer says it wasn't so obvious then.
After the fact, looking back, all the insanities become clear. But in the midst of it, we all get caught up in the excitement and the euphoria and the mania, and it does look rational.
In fact, jumping in can be rational and very profitable, says Duplessis. It's called the greater fool's theory.
You know that you're being a fool, as it were, to engage in the market because the price is clearly out of whack with fundamentals. On the other hand, you count on there being a, quote, greater fool who will buy it at yet a more inflated price.
And here's another thing. Even though prices seem out of whack, they might not be.
It's often difficult to know whether, in fact, this is a bubble, that these assets are overvalued, or whether perhaps this is an understandable price increase.
Because there really is something new under the sun. Railroads, for instance, or the internet. But that's the exception, says Dean Baker. He's with the Center for Economic and Policy Research and was also a student of my old Swarthmore prof, so I guess he wasn't as perplexed as I was.
When you see a sharp departure in fundamentals with something fundamental like housing or stocks, that should always raise clear questions, because these are big markets and it's not that often that we get a whole new world.
Baker was one of the few economists who warned that the housing boom was a bubble, but he doesn't blame home buyers who piled in. They really did risk missing out. He blames fellow economists.
The people I really blame in this story are people like myself, economists, when they should have been yelling at the top of the lungs, raising warning flags, you know, saying this can't go on, it's going to end badly. They were doing the opposite. We're supposed to be the experts, and the experts totally blew it.
With that ringing endorsement, let's go back to our original question. Might the recent run-up in stocks be another bubble? David Blitzer has looked at some key measures of market fundamentals.
They're a little bit high, but they're not outrageously high. Unfortunately for investors, one probably has to keep watching them for the next 6 months or something to get a better signal as to whether we're bubbling or we're just recovering.
Still puzzled, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
Mitchell's not the only guy who's still puzzled, and at least he has an excuse. He's just, you know, a reporter. But apparently some of the bank executives who helped inflate the housing bubble are still shaking their heads. They whined to a congressional panel this week that they still don't understand how their decisions to give mortgages to people who couldn't afford them could possibly have gotten all of us into such a mess. Former Washington Mutual CEO Kerry Killinger told the panel that the government seized WaMu in September 2008 because it wanted to save even bigger banks. Some WaMu offices, by the way, are accused of cutting and pasting fake names onto borrowers' bank statements. Preparing for or predicting the next bubble may be tough. But here's another way to celebrate Financial Literacy Month. Talk to your kids about money. And for those of you contemplating additions to your family, talk about money before you have kids. Both issues are addressed in Jeff Opdyke's new book called Piggy Banking. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So last time we had you here, I think it was for your book about how married couples should merge their finances. I suppose this is the next logical step.
Exactly. You get married, and what do? You have kids. And what comes with the kids? Lots and lots of spending of money.
Absolutely. Well, you know, in the introduction, you pose a very interesting question. Is it ever a perfect time to have a child? You know, you talk about how money becomes a factor in that question. And what's your answer to that?
There is never a perfect time to have a child. And I went through this same questioning of myself when my wife came home pregnant one day. And I was like, oh, my God, no. So the answer is no, there's never a perfect time. And a lot of the arguments are always centered on, you know, do we have enough money to do this? The answer is you probably don't have enough money to do this right now. But you're going to make money along the way, and you're going to change your lifestyle along the way, and you're going to find a way to fit kids into your life. The question is, do you want to do it in a way that you can sort of pre-plan some of these expenses and get a control on your spending and your money and know where it's going, or do you just want to wing it and hope for the best?
And you really talk about how extensive this list of costs is. I mean, it's the diapers and blankets and cribs and that sort of thing. But there's life insurance that all of a sudden you have to think about more than usual. You even talk about, you know, date nights. That's going to cost you something that perhaps it didn't before. Maternity leave and all that has to figure into your budget.
Exactly. That's what it's the sort of the broad point of the book is that there's so many costs that you need to get a handle on. The challenge that most people have with their budget in general, not just as it relates to children, but just in general, is that they don't have a handle on all the costs they really have in their life.
Yeah.
You know, they say, oh, well, I've got a mortgage and I've got, you know, a couple of subscriptions here and I've got to pay for food there. I mean, they really don't have a handle on their budget. And the same thing goes with children. I mean, you have to understand all the costs involved because once you have a kid, you're right, you have to have life insurance to protect your family and protect that kid in particular so that if something happens to you or your wife, there is an opportunity for that child to continue to, you know, pursue education or whatever.
Now, the book is really divided into two topics, and one is, of course, getting ready for the arrival of a child, and the other is teaching that child about money. So let's move on to the money education of the kids once they're ready to do that. What age do you think they are ready to start learning about handling money?
You know, what I say in the book is the minute a child is in a store or even at home and says, I want, that's the moment to begin sort of the financial education process, teaching them there are costs associated with wants, because that's when consumerism begins to kick in. And that's where the necessity for money begins to kick in.
And you have, I think, 15 basic rules for teaching kids about money. And the very first one really fits right into that, which is that spending can only happen after you've earned the money.
That's true. When we talk about children need to earn money before they spend it, I'm not suggesting that a parent, you know, basically stick their child on the street and start panhandling for money or raking leaves or whatever at a very young age. I'm basically saying that children need to understand the concept that the spending that happens happens because of a process behind the scenes that children don't often see these days, and that's earning.
Right.
They know parents go off to work, but that doesn't mean a whole lot to a child. They don't understand that there's a paycheck at the end of the week, and they don't often see parents going to the bank to deposit money these days. Everything is, you know, electronic deposits and direct deposits and all that kind of stuff. So that means it's not an opportunity for mom and dad to explain on the car ride over or standing in line that I'm depositing my paycheck from all this work I've been doing. Mm-hmm. You don't see me go to work, but here's what I do.
A lot of the lessons here are actually about the parents. And you spend a lot of time urging parents to take a look at how they manage their own money, because kids are natural mimics. You talk in the book about, you know, maybe mom and dad are contributing matching funds to the piggy bank. And when they do that, you say, you know, act really excited about it so that the kids are going to feel that excitement and copy it.
Right. Kids are a mirror of who you are. You know, I was out one day running an errand with my son when he was about 5 years old, and he wanted to go to the toy store and buy some collectible trading cards. And I said, Zach, you know, Dad doesn't have any money right now. I can't do that. And he looked at me with this sort of weird quizzical look like I was lying. And he said, you do have money. I said, no, I don't. I showed him my wallet. I said, there's no money. He goes, yeah, but there's a credit card. You use that all the time. And he's right. As a parent, you really want to show your kids, not just tell them, you need to show them how this stuff is supposed to work. If you can show them how mom and dad are saving for the future, they pick up on these lessons that you teach, and they're going to pick up on the actions they see you do.
Jeff Opdyke is the author, most recently, of Piggy Banking, Preparing Your Financial Life for Kids and Your Kids for a Financial Life. Great to have you on the show again.
Hey, thanks a lot.
One element of finance many kids don't find out about until too late is how to pay for college. We have one recent high school graduate's story. To hear her commentary, go to marketplace.org. Ponzi schemes, CEOs defrauding investors and their employees. You can't make this stuff up, can you? But you can riff off of it for a fictional TV show.
You know, these stories don't go away. They may feel like they're ripped from the headlines, but unfortunately these headlines are, you know, now spanning years and years of material.
We talked to the creators of the FX series Damages about 3 seasons worth of personal finance plot lines. That's coming up after we take your questions. As we mentioned earlier, it is Financial Literacy Month, and that goes not just for educating kids about money issues, but adults too. And that's what we do every week on this part of the show. Today, to help answer your questions, I'm joined by Kathy Kristoff of CBS Money Watch. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Tess. It's great to be here.
So how are you celebrating Financial Literacy Month?
The same way as I do all the time. This is the problem with being, you know, naturally financially literate.
Right.
Like, what are you going to do differently? I don't know. I'm still not going to shop a lot because I hate going to the mall. That's probably not being literate. That's just being cheap. But
did you grow up with financial literacy?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I was always a saver. I mean, like literally from the time I could get
really?
An allowance as a kid. Yeah. And my sister was always a spender.
Yeah. So is she getting advice from you now these days?
I guess a little bit. But, you know, yeah. Everybody in my family is pretty buttoned up. There's not a lot of advice to give.
Oh, right.
We spend more time talking about the children than we do about financial stuff. Thank God.
Well, let's go ahead and get to our first caller. Her name is Jen, and she's on the phone from Collingswood, New Jersey. Hi, Jen.
Hello.
Are you celebrating Financial Literacy Month?
Sure. I'm on the phone with you, aren't I?
There you go. I think that's the perfect way to celebrate. So you live in New Jersey. Are you friends with Snooki and the situation?
I watched that show once and it made me throw up a little, so that was the end of that.
And I suppose I should explain that Snooki and the Situation are from the show The Jersey Shore.
They're not even from New Jersey. They're not. They were shipped in.
Well, but my notes here say that you're thinking maybe you're going to move to the South Jersey Shore, right?
Right. Well, the difference is that whole show is not anywhere near where I would like to live. I'm a writer, and I write about the Jersey Shore as my career.
You do?
I do. I'm a travel writer, and I just happen to have written this book about the Jersey Shore 3 years ago, and now everybody wants me to write about some really nice, fun things to do down there. Lucky me.
Well, tell us a few fun things to do.
Some fun things to do. Well, I'm just writing a piece right now about whale watching.
Wow.
Oh, neat. And what kind of whales are there?
Humpback and finback. And Cape May County is the number one birthing place for bottlenose dolphins.
Well, now I've learned something today.
Oh, great.
Are you looking to buy a house on the South Jersey Shore then?
I am. I bought my house in Collingswood 3 years ago. And so I love living in Collingswood. It's about 5 minutes from Philadelphia. It's a really great revitalized little town with a downtown. I don't have to drive my car anywhere. My dog loves it. I have a backyard.
So why would you possibly want to leave?
Yeah.
Because it takes me an hour to 2 hours to get to the shore every day.
Oh.
And every time I leave, it's like my heart breaks a little.
Every time you leave the shore?
Yeah.
Ah.
And I have to make that trip up the Garden State Parkway. And
so just move.
It's a little more complicated than that. I feel like if I sell this house now, I'll be missing something.
But why couldn't you rent it out?
I'm a little worried about being a landlord.
Yeah.
Like that whole prospect is scary.
It is a pain in the neck to be a landlord. I've done this a couple of times.
Have you checked out home prices? Like what you could sell for?
I could probably sell this for about $15,000 more than I paid for it. But to buy down the shore, I'd probably have to buy, the house would be more expensive, probably buy about $50,000 to $70,000.
Can you afford that?
I don't know. That's my question. I don't know what to do. Like, I feel like I got this really great house.
Uh-huh.
I did everything right. It's a great town.
Right.
But I'm just, mentally, I'm not here anymore.
So this really isn't a question with an answer, is it, Kathy?
Well, doesn't
she have to kind of figure out what she really wants to do?
Yeah, I think you need to figure out what you want to do. I think you need to stop thinking that you need to make a decision in a hurry. Just start looking for bargains. You know, talk to a bunch of realtors on the Jersey Shore. If your house might appreciate more in the future and you won't get all that appreciation, who cares? It would come with all sorts of baggage, and your money is really to facilitate your life. And so if you give up a certain amount of, you know, potential future earnings in order to better facilitate your life, that's money well spent or potential money well spent.
Right.
You don't even really know. We're just speculating.
Phantom money.
Yes, exactly. And so that should not be your concern. Your concern should be whether you can afford the house you want to buy. I mean, you talk a lot about how much you love where you are and how it's close to everything. And so I think I would not move until I could replicate what I wanted, you know, and that may not be immediate.
Okay.
So you don't make big decisions like that quickly.
Right. Well, it's such a hard decision.
If you're still uncomfortable about making the decision to sell that house, that means there's still an emotional or physical draw to where you are. And don't sell until you're pretty doggone confident that you want to be someplace else.
Let us know what you end up doing.
I will.
Whether it's, you know, in 2 months or 2 years.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Jen.
Thanks, guys.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or you can always write to us. You can use the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And next we have Eric in Washington, D.C., and it says in my notes here that you left Los Angeles last year to move to D.C.
I did, yes.
I don't understand why anyone would voluntarily leave La La Land. Can you please explain?
A job offer is pretty persuasive.
Oh, yes, it would be, wouldn't
it?
So what were you doing here then?
I was studying at USC, Slavic Languages and Literature.
What does one do with Slavic language and literature?
Well, right now I work at a nonprofit called American Councils, which works with visitor exchange programs for people from former Soviet Union. This is my first job, so I'm kind of low on the totem pole. I'm the one who goes out to the airport and greets them in Russian and brings them back into the city and works with them during their orientation time here in Washington.
So how do you say, I'm very good with money in Russian?
Я очень хорошо разбираюсь в деньгах.
And so are you?
I try to be.
Yeah?
I try to be, yeah.
So what area of your finances do you need a little help with?
Well, I got a notice that one of my credit cards was going to start charging an annual fee, like a lot of
yes.
people have gotten.
Yep, right. We're hearing that a lot. The credit card companies looking for any possible way to make a buck.
It doesn't really make sense to, pay for the privilege of spending my own money, was my thought. But this particular credit card is my oldest card. I've had it for 10 years, and it has a very high credit limit. And I was wondering if closing this account because of the annual fee could actually do more damage than, to my credit in the future than, maybe paying the annual fee.
Oh, boy, the FICO score. I have something I'd like you to take a listen to here.
Okay.
Yeah. Your credit's almost perfect, baby.
Why are you so in love with your credit score? Why don't you marry it?
Well, I don't know. I feel like it will let me do exciting things in the future.
Yes, but Kathy, if someone closes a credit account, how much effect does that really have on their score?
You know what? When you're right out of college, it can have a big impact. That's
like how many points? Is there any way to say?
You know what? There isn't any way to say because there's too many moving parts.
Yeah.
But you could see a drop of 50 points because of that combination on a thin file.
But if he's got an 800 credit score and he goes down to 750, how much difference does that make?
Do you have an 800 score?
No, I probably not. The last time I checked was about a year ago when I applied for an apartment. It was around 720.
Then even taking 10 points off that will make a difference.
Well, yeah, certainly taking 20 points off. 700 is kind of a threshold that in today's world that really makes a difference.
How much is the fee that they are now imposing?
It was interesting because it was more the higher your credit limit is.
Oh, wow.
I think mine was going to be $50 or $60 a year. Yeah.
Yeah. Is this a rewards card?
No, it's not. It's just a really boring run-of-the-mill credit card.
Oh, they so don't want to cancel that. And so I assume that you called them and said, hey, I don't want to pay this fee?
I did call them, yes.
They waived it?
They did, yeah.
They did?
They waived it.
Okay, now I have heard that this is no longer happening. They're not going to help you one bit, and they're happy to say goodbye to you. But that didn't happen here.
It was very unexpected. I called and asked, considering that I've had this account open for so long, if they could be, lenient with this annual fee. And the person I was talking to said, essentially, well, you can just reject these changes to your account and keep your account open.
Really? Does this surprise you at all, Kathy?
Well, I mean, the wording surprises me. I don't think you can just reject it and keep your account open normally. Bunch of reasons why they wouldn't do it. But if you use the card, you have a good score, and you always pay on time, they love you. Because essentially, credit card companies make money on you in two ways, from the interest that they charge on the stuff that on your balance, or from exchange fees. Every time you use your card, they charge the merchant about 3% of the purchase amount. If you're paying off your balance every month, that 3% is risk-free to your lender. And so they really love people who pay off their balances each month because they just get 3% on everything they charge. Charge like crazy, pay off the balance, your credit card company is going to love you and do somersaults for you.
I thought they used to call that kind of customer a deadbeat.
They do, but you know what? Somebody who has a balance is going to bring them in more profit, but that profit comes with a lot more risk.
Wow. So, Eric, you're a success story then.
Well, yeah, good to know. I guess I didn't really realize that they were generating any profit for me since I, paid the balance off each month.
But you still want to make sure that if you aren't using this current card that you have, that they don't reinstate that fee sometime down the line. So you need to keep track of it, particularly if you're not going to close it.
You absolutely have to watch your statements. If they impose the fee, you need to call them immediately and ask them to waive it. And if they won't waive it, then that's when
Well, then you break out the Russian.
That's right. That's right. You can confuse them into submission.
Oh, great. Well, thank you very much.
Well, das vidanya to you, Eric.
Das vidanya.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Evan is on the phone with us from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Hi, Evan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. And for this one moment, I wish we were a TV show so you could do some tricks for us.
Right, yeah.
It says here in my notes that you are a circus performer.
I definitely do circus tricks. I don't work for a circus, but I have a comedy show that involves juggling and magic and contortion.
Contortion.
And I just want to know what your mother says about your career choices here. As a parent myself, I'm like, I'm sorry, Evan, that's too dangerous. Stop that.
I definitely do dangerous tricks, but it's all a calculated risk. And at this point, it's becoming a fairly good living.
So how do you decide to go into this particular business?
When I was 15, I learned to juggle in a Boy Scout meeting, and I enjoyed it. And then in high school, I was taking acting classes, and I enjoyed performing. So I went to circus school after high school.
Circus school?
Yeah. Okay. It was in England.
No kidding.
It was a trip.
Well, you say you make a decent living. Is the stereotype true that entertainers are bad with their money?
Overall, yeah. I would say it's definitely true. There's exceptions to the rule. But my grandfather actually wrote a book called How to Get Rich and Stay Rich.
Wow.
The book basically just says spend less money than you make and invest the difference. I actually had a fairly large amount of mutual funds that was supposed to be for my college education. But since I didn't go to college, I got to keep it. I still have it. Now I get to do other things. Like I'm investing in other things as well. Like recently I got interested in solar energy. I think it's really cool. So I bought index funds in solar energy.
Okay.
Well, it doesn't sound like you need our help.
No, well, my question is about the voting forms that they send me.
Right.
I'm supposed to vote for the board members every year.
Oh, the proxy forms.
They send me these voting forms, and I don't know what to do with them. I don't know who these board people are. They sent it to me twice, and the second time they had a note saying that they have to get, like, a quorum or something, or they have to keep sending out voting forms, and it costs extra money.
Yeah, let's stop here and back up. And, Kathy, let's talk about what these forms are. Anyone who owns a mutual fund, or if you've got a 403B or 401K, a retirement fund of any sort, you're getting these things in the mail. But this is a really great question because, frankly, when I get these in the mail, I think, you know what, I'm one of millions of people who are getting one of these, and it's not going to make any difference whether I vote or not.
Generally speaking, when you get these forms in the mail, you can feel completely comfortable throwing them away. What you're finding with your solar energy fund is that it's a small fund and it probably has very little institutional ownership.
By institutional ownership, you mean pension funds,
right?
Large financial companies, that sort of thing.
Right. You want savvy investors to be invested in your funds. And the reason why is because they're actually going to pay attention, and probably you aren't. Because of that, I'd say you want to probably rethink this solar energy fund.
Hmm.
What this is called is a sector fund.
Energy, healthcare.
Healthcare, exactly.
Biotech.
Real estate, whatever. And unless you have a really large portfolio and you're really savvy about that industry, you probably want to stick with stuff like the Vanguard Total Market Stock Fund, a Total Market Bond Fund, something that's very straightforward, simple, and you're not going to have to vote because you're a piker in their world.
Okay. So what do you think, Evan? You going to throw those away or are you going to take a look?
Actually, that's a really interesting point if I'm going to do a bunch of research. Because I got interested in solar energy and I was excited about all the technology advancements I've been hearing about. And so I went and started trying to look up companies, but I couldn't figure out which one to buy. So I found that indexed.
But you also have to know there's a lot of risk if you go in and buy an individual company.
Yeah. I've got so much other stuff, so I feel like I can take some risk. I'm 28 years old.
Yeah.
I can take some risk and be okay.
I guess someone who juggles flaming torches is okay with a little risk, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for answering my question.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Kathy, before you go, you know, we were talking earlier about it being a financial literacy month, and I thought you could provide maybe a quick hit of advice for one more listener. Catherine wrote in from Baltimore and heard our story a couple of weeks ago about companies that are providing personal finance classes for their workers.
Okay.
Well, she writes that she and her husband pay their bills, but they have no real budget and never seem to be able to fully pay off the credit cards. She wants to know where to go for some reliable help, aside from this show, of course.
Well, yeah, actually, consumer credit counseling services all over the country have free classes, or sometimes they ask you to pay a small fee, you know, $5, $25, something like that, to attend a class. And it's just a basic budgeting, you know, get your life together class. They have classes on home ownership. Some of them are broad. Some of them are really geared to a specific thing. And they're all over the place.
And Catherine, I know that I've also seen classes offered by the local university extension, night classes.
One caution. Some of those. Some of those are offered by financial planners who essentially have something to sell. And so you have to be a little bit careful about those extension classes.
All right. Good advice. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can use the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kathy, thanks so much for taking on some questions with me this week.
Thanks, Tess. As usual, it's fun.
And remember to check with your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. Private jets, 5,000-square-foot mansions, the lifestyles of the rich and famous can take a huge toll on the environment, but money can also buy a greener conscience.
My footprint is less than $100 a month, and you know, calculate it out, I spend less per day on living carbon neutral than I do on coffee.
That story and a chat with the creators of the TV show Damages are coming up. Next week marks 40 years since the first Earth Day. I'm guessing they didn't talk nearly as much about the environment then as we do now. It is not easy being green, but it's a lot easier when you've got piles of green bags. Spendy solar panels, check. Hybrid car, check. Large check to the Sierra Club, check. And why not? A recent Princeton University study reported that the world's wealthiest people cause half of the world's carbon emissions. Ashley Milne-Tite looks at some of the ways the well-off are trying to make up for that.
Actually, the rich are trying to do something about global warming without necessarily changing how they live. Instead, some are buying their way out. Jeff Stewart has two homes, one in Manhattan, one in the Hamptons, so he uses plenty of heat and electricity. He flies all over the world, and he can't see living any other way. But he knows it's bad for the environment. Last year, he started a company with a partner called the Belgrave Trust. It invites people to neutralize their carbon emissions with a few clicks of a mouse.
You simply identify what is your occupation or lifestyle. Are you a financier, or a diplomat, physician, scientist?
Say you're a scientist.
Statistically, we look at what's the typical home arrangement, car arrangement, travel level, and leisure activities for a scientist. In this case, we've assumed 0 hours of private jet travel, 3 short flights.
The website calculates how many tons of carbon that scientist generates in a year. Then it charges the scientist what it would cost to buy those tons plus a service fee. The client's money gets invested in projects around the world that essentially erase or offset pollution from carbon. But recent reports question whether these projects do what they claim. Still, Stewart says it's an affordable first step for the guilt-ridden to write off the damage they do.
My footprint is less than $100 a month, and you know, calculate it out, I spend less per day on living carbon neutral than I do on coffee.
Some critics say curbing your impact on the atmosphere should require some real self-sacrifice. Technology entrepreneur David Kidder is trying a bit of everything. He's 36 and made his first fortune during the dot-com boom. He and his family live in a New York City suburb in an elegant 4,500-square-foot Victorian farmhouse.
So if I show you the before-after pictures, the house was such a disaster. So this is a little pocket room. It's my wife's office here. She's former bank executive. Now she's building a nonprofit with Oprah, so she's very busy doing that.
This power couple has two little boys, a nanny, two dogs, and two cars. Everyone's out right now, and the five-bedroom house is programmed to cut energy use during these hours. Kidder shows me a wall panel with graphics of light bulbs and radiators.
I have the house kind of choreographed, so you can actually turn lights up and down, as well as control heating. And so you're kind of optimizing your energy, so to speak, throughout the day.
Kidder admits he's far from perfect. His wife now eats mainly vegetarian, but he remains an unrepentant carnivore. He still flies a lot. At least he's trying. In Hollywood, people need more of a push. Sean Nibb is a landscape designer in L.A. He focuses on redesigning lawns so they use less of one of L.A.'s scarcest resources, water.
We've had a client that's asked us to abide by the water restrictions in the front of the property that was visible to their neighbors.
So they were seen to be doing the right thing, but at the back of the house, the word was to water a lot to keep everything looking fabulous. Nibb says clients are gradually coming round to the idea that less lawn is good, but they're not driven by concern for the environment.
If you want to get someone to change their consumption or their usage, let's say of water, or rethink landscape design, then you have to approach it from a financial perspective.
In other words, even multimillionaires like to save money. Nibb says after he redesigned one Bel Air couple's lawn, their water bill dropped by nearly half. They were delighted, and they now wear the warm glow of the eco-conscious, at least while they're in their yard. They still get around by private jet. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
And as for the rest of us, those who don't have the coin to buy their way out of green guilt... Well, for a lot of folks, there's just no room in the budget for high-end landscape designers or carbon offsets. But even if you're not rolling in dough, you do have options to curb your environmental impact. Adrian Hill reports.
For some people, living sustainably isn't a choice. It's become a necessity. Just ask Kara Severson, an out-of-work writer hanging out at a local Chicago community center. Reducing her consumption is a side effect of being unemployed.
I guess it's just reusing things more often, like not being so disposable.
Things like glass salsa jars get new life as storage containers. Severson says she's always been conscious about the environment. But without a regular paycheck, her green cred has grown, even without trying. She hasn't had a car in years. Now?
I walk more often because I'm trying to save money on public transportation.
She says when she gets a job again, she'll retain some of the changes she's made, like thrift store shopping. She likes the offbeat clothes she finds. But she's ready to get a job and to spend money on lunches again that come in disposable plastic containers. Severson's greenness comes partly from personal choice. But a lot of Americans aren't really thinking about it. According to a new Gallup poll, nearly half of Americans believe the risks of global warming are exaggerated. But lots of people are making small changes. Gallup finds a majority of Americans claim to recycle and buy compact fluorescent bulbs. For people like Tom Dietz, energy-efficient bulbs save money, and that's the incentive to buy them.
I'm not very politically correct. I don't believe in global warming, let's put it that way.
He's a handyman at a church, and he's shopping for light bulbs at Home Depot. Dietz ends up picking $70 LED floodlights for his sister's house that use far less energy than regular bulbs.
It makes sense if a light fixture claims that it's going to save you a lot of money. It makes sense. I have no problem with that. But I just don't like stuff rammed down your throat, like all these fluorescent screwy bulbs. No one really likes the color.
For him, the greener LED bulb makes life cheaper and easier, which is why he buys it. Of course, there are people on the other end of the green extreme, people like Steve Thorngate and his wife Nadia Stefko.
Making pinto bean soup, using dried beans and onions and some tomato sauce that we put up.
They're vegetarians. Not eating meat is one of the most important decisions people can make to cut their carbon footprint. Some 18% of greenhouse gases come from raising livestock, according to the UN. But that's not the only reason they're veggies.
People come over and they see the kind of food we're serving them. It makes them think about their own habits, and there's a sort of an evangelistic effect, and it all spreads.
They rarely use paper towels. They reuse not too grimy plastic baggies. And their eco-friendly lifestyle extends well beyond the kitchen. No car, they rarely use a clothes dryer, and they make other, more, shall we say, advanced eco-friendly choices.
We let it mellow, yes.
And they shower only about twice a week, give or take.
Often I plan to shower twice a week, and then I keep putting it off a day and another day. Ends up being once a week.
But you don't smell bad, I can attest.
Okay.
Oh, on the radio, yeah, you both smell just fine.
Okay.
But what do all these changes really add up to?
The small things alone aren't going to save us.
Alex Steffen is with worldchanging.com. He says for a new light bulb to really make a difference, people need to grapple with why they're changing out that bulb, about energy and how they use it.
If there's steps towards bigger changes that we're willing to get engaged with, then they matter a lot. If they're just something that we're doing in order to have done something, well, they probably don't add up to all that much.
Real change, says Steffen, requires governments to push innovation and businesses to respond. In Chicago, I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace Money.
What if you could find out why Bernie Madoff swindled investors and where all the money is now? Wouldn't that be so satisfying, even if you didn't lose any money to him? To see justice served? If you're nodding, you'll understand the appeal of the TV show Damages on FX. Glenn Close plays Patty Hughes, a steel-hearted, big-time lawyer who goes after financial crooks like Ted Danson, or at least his character. The season 3 finale is Monday, so we asked the creators of the show to talk to us about why they tapped into this particular world. Glenn Kessler, Todd Kessler, Daniel Zellman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, if you would indulge me for a moment, as a fan of the show, I really have to ask, who killed Tom and where is the Tobin's money?
We can't tell you any of that.
Oh, shoot.
We would be shooting ourselves in the foot to give that away right now.
All right, well, I guess I will wait till Monday then. All right. Well, for those who've been missing out on this terrific series, the reason that we wanted to talk to you, its creators, was because for 3 seasons, in addition to a Rashomon of murder and mayhem, you've been building storylines around your main character, the lawyer Patty Hughes, going to bat for wronged investors. Why go so deep into that particular territory? What was interesting about that to the three of you?
This is Glenn speaking. When we started to work on this show, we knew we wanted to focus on power, and we knew we wanted to focus on how women can yield power in our society and in our culture. And we found that the law was a place where women could rise to great power. And the type of law that Patty Hughes practices, which is high-stakes litigation, is kind of an intersection of business and entertainment and sports and politics. So they were, in the first season, Patty Hughes was actually representing employees of an Enron type of company who had lost everything when their CEO kind of cashed out when he saw that the company was tanking.
This is Daniel Zellman speaking. One of the huge things that got our juices flowing when it came to what we wrote about was the documentary, The Smartest Guys in the Room, about Enron. We were just outraged, I think, personally outraged. You know, in the case of Enron, there were those energy future traders who were just, gleeful about the old ladies who were getting their energy shut off in California. So really, we weren't trying to do a show about a lawyer who defends investors per se.
And this was a classic pump and dump, basically. This is where, you know, he was telling his employees to go ahead and buy up the company's stock while he was actually selling it.
Arthur Frobisher told his employees to invest in the company and then sold his own stock.
He claims he had a prior arrangement with his broker to sell.
You believe that?
And Arthur Frobisher made hundreds of millions in personal profit while his workers lost their pensions, their 401ks, everything they had.
This is Todd speaking. Over the past 3 to 4 years while we've been actually writing the series, just time after time, reports either in newspapers or interviews with people, no one seems to be telling the truth that people are being taken advantage of. Our desire was to put an attorney front and center who will fight for those people and try to get at the truth, even though the methods by which she fights aren't necessarily following the letter of the law.
Well, and then you return to the Enron scandal in season 2, where Patty Hughes goes after a company called Ultima National Resources. And here again, you have yet another evil CEO, this time polluting some groundwater that was killing people. And on top of that, he hired a trader to manipulate energy and stock prices. This really was ripped from the headlines, wasn't it?
This is Todd speaking again. I mean, we started our research for the second season, and it was very much inspired by Bobby Kennedy Jr.
Hmm.
And he's been dealing a lot with mountaintop mining in West Virginia. So he got us turned on to the travesty that's happening in West Virginia. And, you know, that's still in the news with what just happened in the past couple of days with the mine collapse. You know, these stories don't go away. They may feel like they're ripped from the headlines, but unfortunately, these headlines are, you know, now spanning years and years of material.
And that certainly goes then for season three, which is concluding on Monday. Here you had the baddie to end all baddies, Lewis Tobin, otherwise known as Bernie Madoff.
What kind of man steals $70 billion?
The family? They've hidden money, a lot of money.
If you lost money with my father, I'm sorry.
You know what it's like to have a husband who betrays you.
You honestly believe you're going to get away with this?
You know, I know that all kinds of shows have played with this storyline as well, but you actually built an entire season around it.
Yeah, this is Daniel. Initially, I think our instincts were to stay away from the Madoff story per se, but it just became infinitely fascinating to us the more we read about it, and we saw a lot of opportunity for rich character in a family like the Madoff family.
Your main character, Patty Hughes, of course, played by Glenn Close, she really, really hates corporate America and its bosses. And frankly, I guess you were ahead of the times. I mean, corporate America is really the ultimate boogeyman these days, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. This is Daniel speaking again. I mean, you know, our outrage we sort of transplanted onto the Patty Hughes character. But we always look at Patty as someone who hates bullies as opposed to someone specifically having some axe to grind against corporations themselves.
I remember reading a review of season two in the New York Times where it pointed out that your hero is someone who is well-connected, wealthy herself, which is unlike some anti-corporate heroes of previous decades, like Karen Silkwood and Aaron Brockovich, who were kind of accidental heroes, working class. Were you trying to say anything there about the ability of the small guy to go up against the big guy?
This is Daniel again. Yes, absolutely. I think one of the themes of our show is that you sort of need power to fight power. And we're very fascinated by those gray areas, that in attaining the power that one needs to fight power, one is in great danger of becoming corrupt oneself. And that's a huge dilemma. Those movies that you're referencing, Aaron Brockovich and Silkwood, to some extent, those are, I mean, they're great stories, and they're much more feel-good stories than our story. Those, because it's definitely an American fantasy that that someone with no power can rise to the level of someone who can actually fight the big, powerful bad guys.
This is Todd speaking. Another theme of our series has emerged, which is what price success. And someone like Patty Hughes, who gets to decide which cases she wants to take on and knows that getting involved in cases where there's tremendous there's a tremendous antagonist and she's going to have to make huge sacrifices to take down the power center that she's fighting, you know, it reverberates in her personal life. And that's a theme that we've pursued in the past three seasons as well.
So from what I'm reading, I know that a fourth season is up in the air, but maybe a senator who voted for the bailout gets murdered and, you know, Patty Hughes has to solve the entire financial crisis? How would that work?
Is this some fantasy of yours, I guess, that we're tapping into here? Sure, why not? Done.
Todd Kessler, Glenn Kessler, and Daniel Zellman are the creators of the series Damages on FX, which is wrapping up its third season on Monday night. Thanks so much for giving us some of your time. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was wonderful talking with you. Thank you.
I'm kind of sensing that they didn't love my story pitch, so let's hear yours. Go to marketplace.org and give us your plot line for season four of Damages, and promise to let us be your date at the Emmys.
And that's our show for this week. Next time, we pack up the microphones and reusable coffee mugs and head north to the Emerald City, Seattle, where the housing market is far from caffeinated.
Escala here in front of us, it's 230 units, and they've only sold two in the last year and a half.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.